It's a start, John offered, and if left alone, will continue to expand in an orderly way. Groups like the Posse either move out or, if need be, we take them out. We were doing okay with local folks reaching out to the next community and inviting them to join in. Unite or die? Maybe it's unite and live. John, there are 100 enclaves like yours that are making a start, as you put it, from here clear up to Maine. But then what? We devolve into 100 feudal-like states that eventually balkanized the way Europe did after Rome collapsed. You and your friends have done a masterful job of restoring order, civilization, and, from what I could observe, even bringing some technology back online. But reunite everything? Do you have any idea what some other so-called states have devolved into? You most likely know about Chicago, Cleveland, Pittsburgh, New York, even D.C. I've heard some stories. You haven't seen it. I have. D.C. is, of course, gone. A write-off, same as Florida. There are some whack jobs running what they call a kingdom not 150 miles from here that are told to worship their leader as the son of God, and if you don't go along, you are crucified. So why not go after them first? John offered. Weak argument, John. Bait-and-switch logic. It is precisely places like here, where things are being restored, that old values still hold, that we need in our fold before I can take out places like that. So we are back in the fold, is that it? Bob nodded, finally sipping his tea and grimacing slightly. Damn, this is awful stuff, John. Sorry, but that is what we live on. Don't take it as a bribe, but once we get this settled, I've got a convoy coming in with 200,000 MREs. Remember, each of them has a packet of coffee. Do you still smoke? John shook his head. Why, I remember you as being really addicted. I promised Jennifer before she died. Bob lowered his head. Sorry. John could tell the emotions were genuine. We can talk later about all that we lost. And your specific orders. Bob looked back up at him and sighed, obviously not happy about what he had to say next. I'm ordered to place you under arrest and transport you in an expedient manner to Bluemont, to stand trial for murder, the execution of prisoners, and treason. Oh, really? John said, and he could not help but offer a sarcastic grin. Can I have time to say goodbye to my wife? Wife? Guess you wouldn't have known, or would you? I assume Fredericks, before we killed him, was sending up reports. Actually, I didn't know. Who is she? John offered a brief explanation to his old and perhaps now former friend as to how he and Michaela had met on the day and all that had transpired afterward. I had hoped to see my child born, John concluded, but guess you need to haul me out of here ASAP. Bob shook his head. I'm not going to do that. Bob, you have orders to follow. Bob's gaze turned icy cold. Don't push it, John. I'm putting my neck out as is. The original orders were to take this place by force. So why didn't you? Again, don't push it. Just that I knew there was a better way, and part of that better way is to leave you in peace. So I can be a puppet figurehead? Damn, you are hostile, Bob replied. I have every reason to be hostile, John snapped back. We were doing just fine until 2 hours ago. There is a far bigger world out there than this state of Carolina, as you call it. I know that. No, you don't. Not really. Enlighten me, then, sir. Bob began to stand up. I understand your feelings, but if this is how it's going to be, then let's just cut the crap. I'm not going to put you under arrest and transport you to Bluemont, nor anyone else here. He paused. I just implore you to keep things stable with no resistance. You do that for me, and I can skirt around that other order for a while. Aren't you breaking orders? Come on! You know there is always leeway for a commander in the field if he knows how to play it. And something called the Fifth and Sixth Amendments of the Bill of Rights. Does Bluemont even have the right to accuse me of treason, prosecute me for a capital crime? And the Sixth Amendment is about being tried in my state or district where the alleged crime took place by a jury of my peers. Something about our revolution and protest against those being arrested without warning and transported away. It was so important an issue back then that we wrote it into the Constitution. I could cite a few other points from that document as well. Damn it, of course you know I am aware of that. And Blumont isn't? I find that troubling, Bob. Again, don't press me, John.
I'm not pressing you, sir. Perhaps it is you who are pressing yourself.
Damn it, listen to me. Just listen for a minute.
John nodded and sat back, breaking eye contact and deliberately focusing his gaze on the portrait of Washington at Valley Forge.
Asheville and Greenville-Spartanburg are to become the staging area to bring Atlanta back under control.
My God, sir, who is your head of intelligence? Atlanta is a hellhole. You'll be facing tens of thousands down there, the survivors of a dog-eat-dog existence the last 2 years. I know. The southern extent of which you dismissively call the state of Carolina is not 100 miles away from there, and we still, on occasion, have refugees staggering in from there. Word is that Fort Benning collapsed within weeks after the day. After that, posse-like groups moved in and looted out weapons from there. Your force might be facing some nasty ground-to-air stuff. Bob, taking back Atlanta? He sighed. It will make Sherman's job look easy in comparison.
I already know that. Look, John, we've got to get our act together east of the Mississippi, and Atlanta is part of that job. This world is still tottering on the edge of a full-scale nuclear exchange. We are all playing a game of brinkmanship now that we have been pushed off the table as the one remaining superpower we thought we were back in the 90s. It's as bad as, if not worse than, when you were a young lieutenant back in Germany watching the Fold a Gap against the Soviets. There's good intelligence the Chinese have moved surface-to-surface nukes onto our mainland, aimed at here. That is a 7 to 10 minute launch-to-strike time at most.
And our boomers out in the Pacific?
I can't discuss that with you.
Have we abandoned even that?
John snapped. Our only hope of survival is to present a unified nation and do it damn quick. Atlanta is but one part of that equation. To the rest of the world, we look like we're in tatters. That whole damn experiment with the Army of National Recovery made us look even more the fools. Blumont has decided to go to whatever extreme necessary to get the job done and finish it before spring.
Bob fell silent, John returning his gaze to his old friend. He could sense the strain he was under. Something within him felt it was time to finally ask yet again. You sent Quentin to try to reach out to me first, and you did so behind Blumont's back, didn't you?
Kind of.
What do you mean, kind of?
I talked with him about it. Originally, he was to be airlifted down to you as an envoy. I was thinking of dropping him off inside your territory, do it covertly.
But then?
He deserted and did it on his own.
What?
You heard me correctly, and that stays here, okay?
John nodded. Why desert?
He picked up on some rumors, told me the night before he lit out that he could no longer abide by those orders, and the following morning he was gone along with 3 others in a Humvee.
What rumors? Bob hesitated for a moment and then relented, speaking softly.
You asked me about this at the airport the other day, and I didn't feel comfortable telling you then, but now I think it is time you realized what I am trying to contain, what all of us are facing. There's some talk. Can't say how, where, or from whom. Just talk that if need be, Blumont will trigger an EMP.
What the hell are you talking about? John cried. Against who?
Southern United States.
Bob shook his head and then stood up.
You repeat that to anyone and I'll have you gagged and hauled out of here today, whether it turns into a fight or not. I've said too much already.
There was a sharp edge of warning, or was it panic in his voice for having said more than he should have?
You say a word anywhere, and by God, I will ship you to Bluemont, let this place rebel, and then you know the results. Do you read me, Colonel Matherson?
During his entire career under this general, John could only recall several real dressing downs, though he had witnessed it delivered to many another. Bottom line, it was why some stayed majors and colonels, and only a select few had general stars pinned to their uniforms. There, at times, had to be this ruthless edge, no matter whom it was being delivered against.
"John, I'm trying to beat the clock. I have orders to neutralize Atlanta and bring it back into the fold within the month. It's to demonstrate to China and the rest of the world that we are firmly in control of our territory east of the Mississippi. I need Asheville along with Greenville, Spartanburg as secured staging areas for the push south. I need that now."
"Whoever gave you that order is insane. Atlanta is now the lower circle of hell, Bob. You could sink an entire army corps into that place and it will be another Fallujah."
"Don't you think I know that?" Bob replied wearily. "Asheville is part of a far bigger game, and if it doesn't work, Bluemont is willing to do whatever they deem necessary to get their point across to everyone here. It's seen as a message as well to China that we will use any means possible to pacify remaining resistance within our territory, and in turn a clear warning as well to not press us any further."
Whether what he said was planned and intentional or not, he must have inwardly realized he had spilled a highly classified secret. "All right, sir, it stays in this room. You have my oath on that, but please go on." Bob sat down and looked at the half-empty mug of herbal tea.
"You sure you got nothing else here?"
he finally asked, motioning to his empty cup. John nodded, stood up, and without another word went out into the hallway. Several of his students were still hanging about, and he asked them to fetch Kevin Mullady. His campus commander of their battalion was before him less than a minute later. John whispered a request, and Kevin grinned and ran off. It was, of course, a dry campus, but even under the strictest of rules at any such place, there were always some ready to bend those rules, and one had to be foolish not to recognize that fact. Kevin was back in less than 5 minutes, handing over a small hiking backpack. John took it back into the office, closed the door, and produced a quart bottle of moonshine, half full, and just handed it to Bob, who took a long swig and passed it to John, who took a drink as well before putting the lid back on and passing it back.
"One of the traditional products of these mountains," John said, coughing a bit since it certainly was strong stuff and burned on the way down.
Bob took another long sip and nodded his thanks.
"Good stuff,"
he gasped, and he motioned to push the jar back.
"Keep it." "Thanks, I will. Not delve any 15-year-old scotch, but one lives with what they can these days."
He took another sip and sighed.
"All right. John, do I have your sworn oath that what I have said will stay in this room, not even to your wife, who I hope to soon meet?"
John finally nodded.
"Just rumor, mind you. Some chatter my own people picked up off encrypted satcoms. Speculation that to bring down Atlanta and any other pockets of resistance in the South, an EMP will be burst above the Gulf of Mexico coast to knock offline any technology they've managed to bring back up over the last 2 years, and then we move in the following day. Line of sight effect, as you know. It would include here."
"In the name of God, why?" As John asked, he thought of just how delicate the infrastructure his community had managed to bring back online over the last year and a half was. Even a low-yield burst would destroy everything they had managed to recreate.
"Knocks whatever is left down and takes them off balance. You aren't the only one who is getting the genie back out of the bottle when it comes to electricity, getting some cars and trucks running again."
Bob now fixed him with a sharp gaze.
"Or the Black Hawk here and there that has gone missing and could raise hell with our side.
Isn't this a sledgehammer to blot out a fly? What threat do we present?"
"It would be a message to the rest of the world as well, even if Bluemont says someone else did it, that we are ready to do it to the entire rest of the world and will not hesitate to do so. We've been pushed back as far as we will accept and no further. It is a game far beyond you and me, but it will bring down everything you and your friends have created here.
John felt sick inside just thinking of how each small step back from the darkness had so lifted the morale of all. To suddenly have that go entirely down again would be a final death blow. If it was delivered, whoever was left afterward might as well crawl into their graves and pull the sod over themselves and die. He could not reply and just sat there in silence. If at this moment Bob had produced a cigarette, he would have taken it, his pledge to Jennifer gone, for indeed there would be nothing left. No hope left, no dream of rebuilding if this was indeed the level that Bluemont was willing to go to.
"It is why I had to bring you in now, John,"
Bob said softly, taking another sip from the mason jar.
"I'm trying to forestall it, to make a stab at Atlanta first and hope for the best. If that fails, at least I can argue that this region is back in the fold, and if an EMP is detonated, to do it farther out to sea or at lower altitudes so you are not impacted.
Bob, just sit back for another year or two. Let those barbarians left in Atlanta literally eat each other. Then you might be able to move in. But try it now? EMP first or not, you damn well had better have a lot more troops than General Sherman did. Otherwise, it will be a bloody disaster." Bob nodded sadly and then made a show of looking at his old-style wristwatch.
"It's been nearly an hour. I don't want my young officer up there to get anxious and come looking for me. It might trigger something.
The mood my people are in, if he comes down here like gangbusters, yes, it will go bad."
"Then I'd better get back."
Bob stood up, John rising as well.
"What next?" John asked.
"I'm setting up forward headquarters in Asheville. Can you assure me there won't be a fight?"
"Asheville? Not sure. Chances are there won't be resistance. The fight was already punched out of that town long ago. I think, though, your safer bet would be to log her in at the airport, far enough out of town so you don't have to deal with some nutjob sniper, but close enough that everyone will know you're there. If that convoy that's coming up from Greenville, South Carolina, gets through the Green River Gorge safely, the airport would be a good place to rendezvous."
"I'll need the airfield there," Bob replied, "so your suggestion is a good one. We have a couple of C-130s with us in Roanoke that have already touched down on the interstate, but getting the runway at Asheville back up would be preferred, and the Navy can fly some things in as well once we get that runway, your people chewed up, repaired."
Bob looked down at the mason jar. John gestured for him to take it, and Bob slipped it into the pocket of his parka.
"This is the way it is, John. You stay on, function as before, and if you follow my rules, I'll report to Bluemont the situation is under control here and you are under house arrest for now, or better yet, we can't find you, and that this area has achieved level one stability. You've got to stay low. For heaven's sake, don't screw it up by letting Bluemont catch wind that you were out and about. If you do that, I want you to continue to function as before, but behind the scenes. And for God's sake, don't go broadcasting that around, so stay off the radios.
And in return,
I report this area is secure.
And the EMP?
Let me cross that bridge a month from now. Maybe I can talk them down from it. You're right, I know as well as you that trying to take Atlanta now would turn into another Fallujah or even a Stalingrad. I need your help with this. Can I count on you?
John finally nodded in reply, for, after all, there was no other alternative short of seeing another war fought by his community.
"You got a landline down to the airport?" Bob asked.
"We have a line to Hendersonville."
"Is the wire near the airport?"
"It runs along the interstate.
Get one of your people down there today, have them point it out, and I'll have my people link it in. I want that done by tonight. That will then be how we stay in touch."
John nodded.
"EMP, if those bastards are going to do it, what do you do?" "Don't ask me that yet," Bob said wearily.
"Will you give me warning?" Bob stared at him and finally nodded.
If you see me pulling out of here with everything we can haul, pulling back to Roanoke to be out of line of sight, you'll know it's coming. That's the best I can do for you.
And you would let them do that? Bob looked back at the painting of General Washington kneeling in the snow of Valley Forge.
Ask me again in a month.
All right, then, he said, finally adding, Sir?
Thank you, John. I'm sorry it had to be this way. Please keep your people reined in. Let's make this as easy as possible. From here, I'll go straight to Asheville to make sure things are settled down there. Once that phone line is in, I'll be in daily touch.
Zipping up his parka, Bob opened the door, John following him out. Bob paused, looked through the open door into the adjoining chapel, and stepped in. Students up on a high scaffolding, working to repair the damaged ceiling, were hammering away, disturbing the silence. Bob stopped at the back of the chapel, taking it in, John coming to his side.
I remember this place well, from when Mary was laid to rest.
It's the heart of this campus, John said. A lot of days, even before the day, this is where I'd come to pray by myself to sort things out. A lot of hearts and memories are tied to this place. Bob nodded and then simply knelt down, lowered his head, whispered a prayer, made the sign of the cross, and stood back up.
Pray for me, John.
And at that moment, John again fully trusted his old commander. Coming to attention, John saluted him, Bob returning the salute and then embracing him. The chapel was now entirely silent. The students who had been working had stopped and were watching them. Though not planned at all, John knew that word of the prayer, salute, and embrace would spread from one end of the campus to the other within minutes, and for the moment, it had diffused the potential of a deadly confrontation. He walked his friend to the outside door where Maury was patiently waiting. Bob offered him a friendly smile, jokingly asking if he could drive the Jeep on the way back, and his two friends drove off, Bob at the wheel, tires spinning in the snow. As he drove off, John made a mental note to immediately call Ernie and tell him to check the camouflage for the antenna array on the roof of his house. No sense in Bob getting wind that they were already working on their own to try to listen into Bluemont. And with what Bob had just told him, now there was true urgency to that task. John returned to the chapel alone, sat in the rear pew, lowered his head, and, like Washington at Valley Forge, began to pray, while outside snow again began to fall.
Chapter 11 Michaela was fast asleep out on the sun porch, while John dozed in his office, unable to sleep the night after the conversation with Bob and all that had transpired in the previous 24 hours, when the phone on his desk rang, startling him awake. He picked it up before it rang a second time.
Sir, are you safe?
It was Kevin Milady.
Sure, why? Something is up.
John looked at the old wind-up clock on his desk. It was nearly 2 in the morning.
What? Get your wife, get out of that house now, into the woods and lie low.
What's going on? John snapped.
Get out now! We heard a chopper come in, sound muffled, a special ops type machine. One of my people on watch with night vision just saw 8 people get off of the ball field, and they're heading your way. I'm getting a team together. They'll be down there in 5 minutes. Sir, get out of your house now!
John put the receiver down, raced into the sunroom, and grabbed Michaela by the shoulder, shaking her awake.
John, what is it?
He put his hand over her mouth.
We gotta move now,
he whispered, and even as he did so, he thought he saw a glimpse of movement out on the moonlit road.
Now!
He snapped, dragging her out of the bed. A laser dot suddenly flashed onto the wall just as she stood up, and he shoved her down to the floor. One of the window panes shattered, 3 bullets impacting, the wall behind where she had been standing but a few seconds before.
Down, stay down!
He pulled her to the doorway into the hallway, pushing the door shut behind them.
Outside? Whoever it was would expect that. Upstairs was the only alternative. upstairs and hope for enough time for Milady to bring help. "The stairs, quick!" he hissed.
As she started up, he diverted to his office, crouching low, grabbed the Glock off his desk, and turned to follow her. The explosion of a flashbang in the sunroom blew the door he had just closed open, knocking him off his feet. Stunned, he managed to regain his footing, following her up the stairs to the second floor.
Which way to go?
He had thought out so many different scenarios across the last 2 years, but never this one. To be caught by surprise in their own home in the middle of the night. Jen's old bedroom? No, too obvious. Whoever it was would hit there first. Even as he hesitated, another flashbang blew downstairs. The attic. It was a dead end, but it might buy a few more minutes of time. He shoved Michaela to the attic steps, following up behind her, moving backward, pistol raised, ready to shoot if closely followed. A third flashbang, and then the sound of more glass breaking, several short bursts of gunfire. Behind him, Michaela fumbled with the attic door, finally shoving it open. He came up behind her and tried to close the creaking door as quietly as possible. Michaela started to speak, and he put his hand over her mouth. The house-length attic was dimly illuminated by moonlight streaming in through one window. He inwardly thanked God that Jen had been a pack rat, the attic filled with old trunks, racks of clothes from 50 years ago, long-forgotten family heirlooms. He scanned it, seeing where several old steamer trunks were set against a far wall and motioning for Michaela to get behind them. She hesitated, and he shoved her into the dark, musty corner and pushed her down to the floor. She was beginning to sob, and again he had his hand over her mouth and pressed his lips to her ear.
"Are you hurt? What is happening?"
"Just stay quiet. Help's coming." He could see her pale, frightened features in the moonlight. She was protectively clutching her stomach.
"Baby okay?"
he whispered.
"I think so."
"Matherson!"
The voice echoed up from down below.
"Only you we want. Come out. Hands up, and your wife is okay. It's just you we want to go with us."
He looked at her. The offer just a fleeting temptation of a few seconds. They had fired without any warning. Whoever it was undoubtedly had night vision gear and could have seen she would have been hit. This was not for a capture. This was a raid to kill both of them. And if this was from Bob Scales, and he survived, he would find a way to ensure his former friend roasted in hell.
30 seconds, Matherson. Just come down with your hands up.
He knew better than to reply. From down below, he could hear that someone was creeping up the stairs to the second floor. Even before the 30 seconds were up, another flashbang went off. Just beneath them, the concussion startling him and Michaela, who was unable to suppress a gasp of fear. He put his hand on her shoulder. She was shaking like a leaf. Seconds later, a long burst of gunfire swept the master bedroom below. Silence for a moment, and then footsteps creaking along the old wooden floor corridor below.
3 more flashbangs popped off, detonating in the guest rooms and bathroom, dust from the low ceiling of the attic swirling down from the concussions, more gunfire as they swept each room. "Matherson, you're cornered. Save your wife and just come down. We know you're up there."
Michaela reached out to clutch his side, an affirmation that he was not to surrender.
"It's going to hit hard. Be ready. Keep your mouth open," he whispered.
He heard the door up to the attic creak open, and something arced up into the attic. He crouched down behind the steamer trunk, opening his mouth wide to lessen the impact of the explosion on his eardrums. It detonated with a blinding flash, the shockwave hitting so hard that Michaela gasped. He knew he had but an instant to be ready and was back up, Glock firmly held in both hands, resting on the top of the steamer trunk. Gunfire snapped up from the stairwell, and then the first assailant appeared. John knew the target would be small. Face only, helmet and body armor covering the rest. The man rose halfway up, laser sight flashing along the opposite wall, and then turned toward where John waited 30 feet away. The laser lights sparkled in John's eyes, nearly blinding him, and he squeezed off shot after shot. One of the 9mm rounds must have hit squarely. The killing shot he anticipated in return was a long burst going up over his head, and then stitching across the ceiling as the man he hit tumbled back down the stairs. He could hear muffled cursing, and then a fusillade of fire erupted, smashing up through the floor of the attic and started to stitch toward them.
"Curl up on top of the trunk!"
John yelled, pushing Michaela up as he remained crouched, weapon trained on the stairwell.
"How many shots did I fire?" he wondered. "How many left?"
and then he heard it. An explosion of gunfire outside his home. Shouts, curses, more shots, several grenades going off. He waited for whatever came next. A grenade came up from out of the stairwell. He pulled Michaela back down from the trunk and held her tightly. This time, it was fragmentation showering the room with a deadly spray that, if not for the packed trunks, would have surely killed them. There was more gunfire from outside, several long, sustained bursts, and he waited, the seconds dragging into minutes. Michaela was by his side, curled up, sobbing. He did not dare to look over at her for even a second, all attention focused on the staircase. To add to it all, he could smell something burning, and smoke was beginning to curl up from the stairwell.
"John! John and Michaela!"
The voice was high-pitched, frantic.
"It's Grace Freeman. For God's sake, please answer. Please!"
Long ago training. They take one of yours, put a gun to their head, and get them to cry out. He didn't budge.
"The house is burning. My God, sir, where are you?"
He could hear someone running into the corridor downstairs, continuing to shout his name. There was a pause, and then the stairs up to the attic began to creak. He was still holding the Glock, a weapon where the safety was built into the trigger. Just apply a few extra pounds of pressure, and it would go off again. A head appeared, hard to distinguish due to the ever-increasing smoke.
"John and Michaela?"
"Grace, don't move," John hissed, still not sure if she was being pushed forward by an attacker.
But he had to take the risk of replying. She looked his way.
"Are you safe?"
he whispered.
"Damn it, sir, this house is burning. We gotta move,"
she cried.
"We got the place secured. Come on, come on."
John reached down, pulling Michaela to her feet, Grace coming around to Michaela's side to help. It was no time for questions as they headed for the stairs. John paused for a second, looking around. He saw an old shirt dangling from a clothes rack, tore it off, and covered Michaela's face, shouting for her to take a deep breath and then hold it. With Grace leading the way, they fumbled down the stairs. John guided Michaela around the body sprawled out by the attic door. A round had caught his would-be assassin just below the nose, and he thought to actually pause to see if the man was still alive. Smoke was pouring out of the master bedroom. Michaela was clutching his hand tightly and dragging him along, guided by Grace, with a cold sense that even if the man was alive, he would be dead anyhow in a few minutes from that wound he left the body behind. Coughing, gasping for air, Grace led them down the steps to the ground floor. The sunroom was engulfed in flames. Grace staggered from the blast of heat, and John, coming behind the two, shoved them forward and out the back door.
"I got them out,"
Grace cried, and then she leaned over, retching and gasping for air. John could hear shouts, and through watery eyes he saw Milady come up, weapon raised. He shoved John to the ground, another of his students shielding Michaela with her body and more gently easing her down to the ground.
"Situation,"
John gasped, looking up at Kevin.
"At least four got away,"
Kevin shouted.
"One dead up on the second floor,"
Grace gasped.
"At least three, then."
Someone had peeled off a parka and was putting it over Michaela, crouching down to help shield her. John started to come to his feet, but Kevin snapped for him to stay down. Whoever was after him was still out there. He looked back at the house. An upstairs window burst, flames licking out. All of it was going up. Whoever they were, they must have dropped thermite grenades to set it afire like that. Jen's house was going. All of it going. And then the thought hit. Someone was draping a parka over him. He pulled it off, held it to cover his face, and ran back into the burning house, tearing free from someone who was trying to hold him back.
"John!"
It was Kevin coming up behind him, trying to pull him back.
"No!"
John tore himself free and staggered into the sunroom. Nearly blinded by the smoke, he fumbled about on the windowsill, found what he was looking for, and crouching low, parka held up against the heat, he staggered back out. Once outside, he collapsed into Kevin's arms. He clutched Rabs tight to his chest. He would never let Rabs burn like that. Sitting in President Hunt's office, he gratefully took another sip of moonshine and looked over at Michaela, who was resting on the sofa, two of the girls she had trained as nurses hovering over her. One of the girls looked back at John and smiled reassuringly.
"She's okay, and so is the baby."
He could barely see her smoke-smudged face looking toward him in the blacked-out room, curtains drawn. She started to cough and then managed to clear her throat.
"Moonshine is the last thing you should be drinking now, John Matherson," she whispered, her voice husky. "I know. And damn it, if not for the baby, I'd join you," came her reply.
A burst of gunfire echoed in the distance, and he could tell the difference of who was firing. Sustained bursts versus three-shot replies. Whoever they had cornered next to the cafeteria was firing back like a professional, conserving ammunition. John stood up and went to the window to at least slip the curtain open to see what was happening, but Kevin reached out and blocked him.
"Their goal, sir, was to kill both of you. You're staying here until this is over." "Those are..." He hesitated for a moment. "My kids out there doing my job."
"They're your troops doing the job you trained them for." Kevin paused to add emphasis to his next word.
"Sir."
There was a sudden explosion of gunfire, long, sustained bursts, and regardless of Kevin's orders, he was not going to cower here, not after what they had done, and he carefully parted the curtain a few inches to look. He could see the tracers snapping into the side of the cafeteria and what had once been a peaceful outdoor patio. Several dozen students had the area surrounded and were unleashing a fury of fire. One of their targets got up, trying to pull up someone else. John had ordered that, if possible, take them alive, but the rage unleashed by the assassination attempt could not be contained. In spite of body armor and helmet, their target's legs and face were nevertheless exposed, and he was finally dropped. The other one, obviously wounded, tried to get up, and another explosion of fire took him down. More shots continued to pour in until finally the cries went up to cease fire. John started for the door, but Kevin blocked his way and made it clear by the way he stood in front of John that if need be, he'd physically take him down, something that Kevin was more than capable of doing.
"Let someone report in," Kevin snapped.
"For once, John," Michaela whispered. "Listen to someone else. He's right."
John simply nodded and then went over to his wife's side, sat down on the floor by her side, and took her hand.
"Are you really okay?"
"Just some smoke, John, that's all."
"The baby?"
he asked nervously. She tried to laugh, but started to cough again.
"Scared the shit out of the little bugger. He's been squirming like a kickboxer ever since it started."
She paused.
"Our baby is okay."
She leaned over and wrapped her arms around his neck.
"Why would your friend do this to us?"
she asked.
"You said he was honorable."
"I don't know,"
John whispered.
"I just don't know. Matherson."
It was a whisper from the corridor, followed by a knock. He recognized Reverend Black's voice and started for the door, but Kevin stepped in front of him and opened it, shielding John. It was indeed Reverend Black, and Kevin let him in. Black went past John, knelt down by Michaela's side, and taking her hand, whispered a brief prayer of thanks, and then looked back at John.
"I got him on the phone, John. Pick up the line here."
John nodded.
"Did you tell him what happened?" "I just did as you said, told him it was an emergency and to hold on the line." "John, don't talk to him,"
Michaela said.
"It'll tell him you're alive and they'll come back."
His rage was nearly out of control. Hit him, that was part of it all, but to include his pregnant wife? For that matter, Elizabeth, her baby, and husband could have been in the house as well. The attack was not to just capture him, it was to kill him and anyone with him. He looked at the two girls tending to Michaela, and then at Kevin.
"As soon as you think it's safe to move her, take her somewhere secure. And don't tell me where it is until this is over with."
She started to protest, but a sharp glance from him stilled her voice.
"It is about you and the baby now, not me,"
John said sharply, and she did not reply. He walked back to the desk and picked up the phone. "General Scales, are you on the line?"
"Yeah, John, what the hell is going on?"
"Perhaps you should tell me exactly what the hell is going on, you son of a bitch."
"John? Come after me, fine. That's part of this game you're playing, and I'll accept that. But my pregnant wife?" "John, in the name of God, what is going on up there?"
"You tell me," John said again, uttering each word slowly and with unrestrained anger. There was a long pause.
"John... whatever it is, tell me exactly what is going on." Why don't you come up here yourself and explain it?
He paused.
Sir?
Another long pause.
John, just tell me, will you?
Fine, then. Play innocent. I trusted you, and less than an hour ago, 8 of your stormtroopers hit my house. If my people had not spotted them first and reacted, they would have killed my wife and the baby within her, and then me. That's what happened up here.
God in heaven,
Bob whispered.
Yeah, God in heaven, Bob.
Where are you, John? Do you honestly think I'd tell you? Just know that wherever Michaela is now, she is safely stashed away. There was another tap at the door, the person out in the corridor identifying herself as Grace. Yet again, it was Kevin who answered. He cracked the door open and, recognizing her, let her in. Don't hang up, General Scales. I'll be back. He put the phone down and looked at Grace. Her once beautiful hair was badly scorched, the right side of her face blistered. She tried to talk and began to cough.
Young lady.
It was Michaela.
You get that burn treated right now.
In a moment,
Grace replied, and then she looked back at John.
7 accounted for, sir. We think 1 slipped through and is heading up toward Lookout Mountain. We've got a full platoon tracking him. He's wounded and trailing blood.
Our side?
John asked, suddenly nervous.
How bad?
She hesitated and then looked over at Kevin, who nodded.
5 dead, 12 wounded at last count.
Who?
She began to rattle off names, and John sagged with a sudden weariness. One was the girl he had seen running with her lover in the snow just days ago. Another, Jim Sutherland, a beloved art teacher who had decided to live on campus and wasn't even part of the militia, but apparently had turned out with the others. Let the last bastard go, John said, shaking his head. These people were well trained. I don't want anyone else hurt in this affair. You got that, Grace?
Yes, sir.
But as she turned, John saw the exchange of glances with Kevin. They were out for vengeance and knew as well that as long as one of the hit squad was still alive, their beloved leader and his wife were not safe, at least for the moment. Grace closed the door and John picked the phone back up. Bob, you still there?
John, I've ordered a chopper to start running up. I'll be there in 15 minutes.
General, you come up on a chopper, and I promise you my people will shoot it down. They're in a killing mood. 5 of my students and friends died rescuing my wife and me.
The enormity of their sacrifice hit him. It was amazing it was not 5, even 10 times that number, given whom they went against.
I got at least another dozen wounded. You fly up here, and you and your crew will be added to the list. Now, if you want to bomb the place, just go ahead, but this entire campus will be evacuated before you get here. John, please listen to me. I don't know what the hell you are talking about. Are you hearing me?
Yes, I'm listening.
Whoever it was not me or anyone in my command.
John sat down. Bob's words were what he wanted to believe.
Can we do this, John? What, damn it?
I'll come up alone, in a Humvee with just a driver, at dawn, so there is no confusion in the dark. Your people can stop and search me at the security gate you have out on the interstate.
Until you prove yourself different, Bob, it's on your head. Okay, come on up. Stop at the security gate, but if my people see 1 additional vehicle or hear anything overhead, all bets are off.
All right. I'll be at the gate come dawn.
And what's to prevent you from having a few F-18s up at 30,000 feet?
I have no reply other than my word.
He paused.
And memory of your Jennifer to guide me now.
With that, John looked down at flame-scorched Rabs, whom he had placed on the desk.
Dawn, then.
General Bob Scales stood with arms extended straight out as 2 of the security guards at the exit 59 barrier roughly patted him down and then none too gently pushed him forward. Contrary to Kevin's, Reverend Black's, and his own wife's appeal, he had decided to meet Bob at the gate. If anything was to go down, he'd rather it be here than down on the campus. He had forsaken Maury's far too easily identifiable Jeep, and instead had Black drive him to the meeting in his old Volvo.
Lee had shown up and insisted he go along as well. Kevin had already gone ahead with several carloads of the militia and a pickup truck with a package in the back for Bob. The guards pointed to where John waited, standing under the roof of a makeshift shelter that had been erected to protect the interstate security team. Bob approached slowly, keeping his hands out and clearly visible. There were no salutes, no friendly exchanges other than a warning from Kevin that if he made the wrong move, it would be the last gesture he would ever make. "How is Michaela?" Bob finally asked. "Are she and your baby okay?" "They're fine," was all John could say, and then he looked past Bob to Kevin. "Go ahead and show him what we brought along." Kevin put his hand on Bob's shoulder and guided him to the back of the pickup truck and pulled off the tarp covering the rear of the vehicle. Bob stared for a moment and then looked back to John. "Upon all that I hold sacred, John, I swear to you they are not mine. I've never seen them before." "We stripped them of their gear," Kevin said coldly. "High-quality stuff, regular army. The one Colonel Matherson shot in the face was roasted to a crisp when his house burned. His grave is the rubble that's still smoldering. We're still hunting the last one, but he won't last long. He's trailing blood. You want them back, sir?" Bob looked over sharply at Kevin and shook his head. "Bury the bastards wherever you want. They're not mine, and that's final." "Kevin, take them to where we dumped the bodies of the dead posse. That's all they deserve." As he spoke, he watched Bob closely. Both he and Bob had been taught a code of honor when it came to their own dead. Not even a body was ever to be left behind, no matter what the cost of retrieving it. Bob did not flinch or show the slightest emotion at John's cold words of scorn. "John, if there is nothing else, do I have your permission to leave?" John could only nod. Bob turned and started to walk back to his Humvee. "General Scales?" Bob turned and looked back. "If not you, then who?" Bob stopped, and then slowly walked up to John, stopping almost within touching distance. Kevin was on one side of him, Lee on the other, and both were tense, ready to spring. "Look me in the eyes, John." John did as requested. "Upon the memory of Jennifer's grave, and wherever my Linda now rests, I swear to you I did not do this." "Then who?" "I gave you a warning. There are more than a few who want you dead, John Matherson. I hate to think it is who I now suspect, but maybe it is." John took that in, but did not reply. "And if so, and if they tried for you in your home, they know more about you than even I do. It means you have someone in your community who has given information out." He paused as if suddenly realizing something. "And it means they know that you and I have talked." He stood silent, as if evaluating that thought. "God be with you, John," Bob whispered. "And maybe I should ask that he be with me as well in the days ahead." John did not reply as Bob turned again and walked back to his Humvee, which backed up, turned, and then sped off. "I don't believe him," Lee finally said, and Kevin nodded. John kept his thoughts to himself and then finally looked at Kevin. "Dump their bodies, like I said," John finally said. "And Kevin, keep a 24-hour watch on Michaela, and I am not to know where she is." "Already taken care of, sir." "Lee, mind if I bunk with you?" His friend smiled and nodded. Chapter 12. "Ernie, I need something, and I need it now," John announced while still standing out in the snow in Ernie's driveway. For once, Ernie was out the door to greet him and actually grabbed John by the hand. "You okay? We heard about what happened last night. Michaela, is she okay?"
"Yes, just fine. We're fine."
"Those sons of bitches."
Lee had thrown a fit when, at midday, John had roused from his exhausted sleep and announced he was going to visit Ernie. That had triggered an explosion of anxiety, with Kevin appearing with a pickup truckload of their troops, fully armed, several of them wearing the captured gear taken from the dead raiders.
The last attacker had been found dead shortly after dawn, having apparently bled out from his wounds, and after being stripped he had been dumped with the others. At least for the moment, it meant to John that he was safe and would not let what happened stop him from his routine, and that included using Maury's jeep when it was snowing, so he ordered Kevin and the others to relax and get some sleep, an order reluctantly obeyed. "Mind if we come in?" John asked, nodding over to Maury, who was standing beside his jeep and throwing blankets over the seats to keep the snow that was falling from covering them.
"Why don't you have a top for that damn thing?" Ernie asked, shouting to Maury. "Couldn't find one that was authentic to the period." "Oh, great! Historical accuracy before comfort!"
Maury did not reply. John knew it was painful enough for his friend to redo the paint job back early in the spring to cover over the white star on the front hood and paint the rest in a speckled camouflage pattern, which of course Maury had to match up with the Normandy 1944 look, so it was less easy to spot them from the air. Maury just glared at Ernie and did not reply.
"All right, you two, come on inside."
He motioned to the door into the garage. Slamming it behind the two, Ernie turned, arms folded defensively.
"Are you going to shut me down?"
he asked sharply. "Hell no."
"Well, I heard you were taking orders from our new potentate down at the Asheville airport and assumed you were sent here to pull the plug after he failed at his attempt at killing you."
"Damn it, Ernie, did anyone ever discuss diplomatic conversation skills with you?"
"Nope, and if anyone ever does, I'll tell them to go to hell."
John couldn't help but smile. "Yeah, okay. Everyone knows. I surrendered without a fight. You got an alternative short of a bloodbath for our side? As to damn near getting killed, just leave that be for now."
"How many troops does he have with him?"
"He's got at least half a dozen Black Hawks, maybe as many Apaches, a couple of C-130s, and from what our lookouts in Hendersonville told us, at least half a dozen Bradleys and a dozen truckloads of supplies and additional troops up from Greenville. And you suggest we fight that?"
"Go up into the hills and wait him out. He'd be facing half a thousand or more very pissed off, well-armed folks."
"Ernie, you have been a burr under my hide from day one, but this tops it. I'm supposed to go back to those kids at the college and tell them to suit up and head out into the woods in this weather?" He snapped out the last words and pointed back outside where a lightly falling snow was being whipped along by 20-mile-per-hour winds. Half of them would freeze to death within a couple of days out there with no fires to keep warm. Light a fire, you got an Apache with infrared seeking on top of you.
"He's right, Ernie."
The two turned to see Linda slowly coming down the basement stairs. "So stop needling him. You know as well as I do there was no chance to fight back, so let it be."
"I was just suggesting an alternative, Linda."
"Fine. You suit up, take a rifle, go sit out on the ridge for a few hours, and then come back and tell us if we should fight or not."
"I'm 75. Those kids trained to fight are in their 20s.
She ignored him and walked up to John and Maury, holding out two mugs of coffee.
"We don't have much of that stuff left," Ernie muttered.
"They need it more than we do warm inside here," she snapped, and then turned her attention to John. "Really, are you and Michaela all right?"
"Just fine, Linda. It was bad, though, for those at the college. 5 dead, 12 wounded, and I doubt if a couple of those will make it." He tried to say those words without becoming emotional again. They had died saving his family and him. All of this was becoming too much to bear. He knew if he broke in front of Linda, she would go all to pieces as well. He shook it off and just offered a weary smile of resignation.
"My only other question, John. Do they know about our operation here?"
John shook his head. "So far, I don't think so. That's why I called and said to double-check the camouflage on your satellite dishes.
You can't see them from the road or from up above. I had the kids make some netting out of bed sheets to blend in with the snow. I think we're safe."
"Good. That's the way I want to keep it."
He could see that Ernie was still glowering and felt it necessary to smooth the waters.
"Ernie, I'll admit now, it was a smart move to shift your operation down here. The last thing I want is another war. You saw what a couple of Apaches under Fredericks did to us in the spring.
Their only tactical mistake was basing out of the mall. If they had been based at the airport with proper security, Fredericks would have won. We don't have Stinger ground-to-air missiles, and any Hollywood hokum about taking one of those birds out with an old-fashioned RPG is absurd. General Scales held the trump card, made sure we saw it in his opening move, and won. He played it well, Maury interjected. There was nothing we could do in response. At least for now. But, Ernie started, and Linda cut him off.
But what? 100, 200 kids dead?
They're not kids, Linda.
We've got grandchildren that will be in the militia units in another year, Ernie. To me, they're kids.
John caught her eye and nodded. Strange. When his second lieutenant's bars were pinned on him, he was 21 and felt he was indeed a man. His father had been flying combat missions at 23, his grandfather at 21. Of course he felt like a man then, but now, when there was an entire generational difference between him and those who were actually the ones who would carry the fight, it was also different. He recalled the old photo books of soldiers from World War II, the haunting image of a shell-shocked Marine covered in filth and blood, staring at the cameraman with vacant eyes. One had to look deep into that photograph to conjure out the realization that the frightfully aged Marine most likely was, in fact, not more than 18 or 19 years old. Those whom he called kids, when looking up at the Apaches circling over the campus, were again ready to fight, but in their eyes they had as well that same haunting gaze. They were veterans of 2 major battles, and they knew the price and the loss even when they won. They were ready to fight, even though with the pragmatic realism that only a veteran could gain, they knew without doubt the fight would most likely be futile. Memory of his walk up to the campus of several weeks back came to him, the young amorous couple playing in the park. That should be their world, holding with it some hope of a future, not another fight to the death. And now one of them was indeed dead. The thought of that stabbed deep. But he had to push it aside for now. Damn all that created this world for them, he thought bitterly as he nodded, still looking at Linda. You're right, Linda, they're still kids, or at least should be kids. I'm not going to spend their lives in some final gesture of defiance. And even as he spoke, the nightmare of what Bob said might happen, that Bluemont might unleash another EMP, hung over him. After what had happened just hours ago, he was no longer sure of Bob, though as emotions settled, he did want to believe him. Perhaps now the answer to it all was to find out, on their own, what the truth really was regarding Bluemont, and what was happening in this house might be the key. He suddenly realized that he had been standing in quiet contemplation for several minutes while Ernie and Linda had launched into what he realized was something of a standard method of communication between the two. Ironic, as he focused attention back on them, they obviously loved each other dearly, and yet they sure had a strange way of expressing it. All right, you two, let's chill it. It was Maury who finally interrupted the argument. The two looked at him, and Linda smiled.
Thank you, Maury. Point taken. At least by me.
Ernie said nothing and finally turned back to John. Let's answer the first question, then. If you are not shutting us down, why are you here?
I just want an update and to pass along a few suggestions. I want your team to lie low, but keep the kids working here on task 24/7.
So, you are not this General Scales's lackey? Ernie quipped.
You know, Ernie, someday when all of this is over, you and I are going to have a real serious discussion.
Just remember, Matherson, I saved your life. Fredericks was ready to shoot you in the back.
Yeah, right.
Ernie smiled. Well, Summer Whispering, I just simply saved you from the dilemma of what to do with that son of a bitch by just shooting him and getting it over with. Either way, I did you a favor.
John finally relented and nodded. This basement is freezing, Linda announced. Let's go up to the Skunk Works.
The what?
John asked. That's what we're calling it now. The kids like the name, especially after I told them about a little side contract work we once did at the real Skunk Works Lockheed had.
John smiled at that. Lockheed had been a prime contractor for highly specialized spy planes back during the Cold War, their secret R&D lab dubbed the Skunk Works. It fit for what they were doing now. Linda led the way up to the main floor of their home, again cheerily warm, thanks to the fireplace and the wood-fueled kitchen stove. She led them up to the second floor, moving a bit slowly, bracing her knee as she climbed the stairs, muttering that she wished she'd had the replacement knee surgery done before everything had hit the fan. As they reached the top of the stairs, John looked up and grinned at the hand-drawn sign hanging in front of them. Linda and Ernie's Skunk Works. Whoever had drawn it was indeed creative. Linda and Ernie caricatured as cartoon skunks, arguing with each other with an array of $##%, erupting from the skunk image of Ernie's mouth, even as they were holding hands. The entire room was now cluttered with electronic equipment, most of it retro from the 80s and 90s, but some of it looking fairly recent. The work crew had grown from the 5 he had seen last time to 9, hunched over screens, empty plates and cups strewn on the tables and floor. That alone made John wonder how many precious